This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
By the book on BFM 89.9.
Shining bright above you, night breezes seem to whisper, I love you. Birds singing in the sycamore tree, dream a little dream of me. Say nighty night and kiss me.
Hello everyone, you are listening to By the Book. I'm Lee Chui Lin, and with me today my fellow dreamers Shamila Ganesan and Hanif Baharuddin. And of course Hanif is here because he is our honored guest. This is a quarterly book club, actually, in which we are making our way through Neil Gaiman's The Sandman. We are currently up to volumes 6 and 7, Fables and Reflections and Brief Lives.
Yes, and when we kind of first divided up the books, honestly, I didn't know whether we had a proper structure, but I also feel like nobody saw 2020 coming. And in that sense, I feel like Fables and Reflections and Brief Lives ties together very well as both the possibly the best and worst 2020 reads in terms of the Sandman collection, because it's got so much to do with change and so much to do with time and things beyond our control. And I don't know, I felt that rereading these books at this point in time in particular was very interesting for me.
Yeah, I agree with Sharmila to a certain extent. I feel like even at this juncture, the story that I think Sandman is trying to tell has gone to that stage where it started becoming a bit more personal, started becoming a bit more reflective to a certain extent, and it's also becoming a bit more serious, especially for certain characters.
I think what we're doing is hitting a point where it really is about whether or not dream can change and transform. And I mean dream the character, because of course we've been with him now for 7 volumes. This is, you know, this makes 7. And you get to see him transform. His long imprisonment that we saw him escape from in the first book was the beginning of that. But through it all, you get the sense that the character that you meet, say, 500, 700 years ago, or that different people are interacting with, is ultimately not the same more introspective dream or more open dream that you meet in these volumes, who's maybe open to saying yes to his little sister in their hunt for their brother, and, you know, things like that, things that he would never have considered in the past. But at the same time, he's also still a lovelorn, overdramatic fool. So there is that.
So I think it's it would be quite useful to look at the two volumes separately as a lead into each other. So the book 6, which is Fables and Reflections, follows one of possibly my favorite formats that various volumes within the Sandman series does, which is like little snippets of dreams interactions with different characters. And in this case, it's very much characters from history, both well-known characters as well as maybe characters that you don't know so well. And then woven into it, though, which you don't see coming, is a deeply personal story of Morpheus, which is, of course, Dream's name, as well as a child that he had, a son. And that's drawn from Greek mythology. So that's a little bit of a sucker punch, but I very much enjoyed Fables and Reflections because I loved all the little stories that we get to read about.
Mm. I like Fables and Reflections too. I do agree with you, Sharmila. I enjoy Sandman when it's trying to tell that kind of story where stories that are not so much a continuity. So I enjoy the parts where they're trying to tell the story where it's not part of the bigger continuity of the story. But I was surprised, and I was pleasantly surprised when I started reading the story about Orpheus, because it was also a personal story between Morpheus and his son, and also how eventually it led up to Morpheus meeting his brother, Destruction, right? Which is a character that up until this point in the book, we have not seen yet. Yeah, so jumping the gun a bit here, but as much as I like the parts where we are focusing more on these little stories, I was pleasantly surprised, and I really enjoyed the chapter with Orpheus.
I think what the smaller stories offer is an opportunity to see the power of dreams and to see Morpheus really flex in many ways. And also, in that same vein, Neil Gaiman is flexing, because the little stories, we haven't mentioned them in much detail, and we'll get to the Orpheus centerpiece, because I think that really is the heart of the book. But you see characters, you know, involving the first and only emperor of the United States. You see stories involving Marco Polo. You see stories set in Baghdad in the month of Ramadan. And I think you get to see the different art and different styles of writing and language that Neil Gaiman is so... so good at, really, so comfortable in. And that's a pleasure. I mean, the drawings and the stories in this particular volume, I think, are some of my favorites ever.
I think it also, because Sandman came before many of his novels, which later went on to become such a big part of the fantasy genre, you can see the glimmerings of that kind of writing, the drawing on mythology. Well, glimmerings is actually a huge disservice. You can see the roots and how he enjoys playing in that space of taking history and mythology and characters that really existed, stories, and just sort of flipping them around and twisting them and inserting this idea of dreaming into all of them and making it such a strong part of their stories as well. It also creates a background for you to then appreciate the personal, because you get a sense of how huge Morpheus's scope or scale or life is. And then juxtaposed against that, you have this deeply personal, existential family story. And I think that contrast works really, really well.
Yeah. I think at this point in time, Gaiman has become a bit more comfortable in using that format, right? Where he, in some chapters, he will use Morpheus sparingly and focus on telling stories that are more focused on other little characters, right? And I'm, like I said before, I've always enjoyed that aspect of Sandman, where it's not so much about Morpheus, as much as Morpheus is an interesting character himself. I always feel like these are the moments sometimes that I look forward to reading Sandman, when it's just Gaiman playing with all these mythologies, all these characters from myths, literatures and whatnot, and interweaving Morpheus sparingly as part of the story. Yeah, I appreciate the United States of America. What was the title again? Sorry, the Emperor...
Well, I can't remember the name of the story, but it's about the first and last emperor of the United States. It's one of my favorites.
Yeah,
same
here.
It's called 3 Septembers and a January.
Yeah, that one. And also, yeah, even Ramadan is an interesting story in itself.
Okay, so I agree in that I like the wandering. I like the fact that, because I think Morpheus, like any great hero, is... it's nice when you use him sparingly, because then you get to see how strong a character he actually is, because you don't need a lot, right? It's like a little goes a long way. But the themes of the book that will ultimately come up in later chapters that have already been touched on in earlier volumes, not all of the Endless get along. The Furies or the Kindly Ones are going to be an important element in what happens. The baby Daniel, for instance, who's also going to play a pivotal role in the future. These characters and these elements are also woven into the stories very lightly. You don't have to kind of pay attention too much to them. But if you have read the thing in its entirety, or if you are rereading it, then I think these are little rewarding bits for you to pick up on and go, ah, there it is again.
I think we've come to the point in the conversation where we can no longer not talk about Orpheus and Calliope and that part of, because really that's how this book, Fables and Reflections, connects to the next one, which is a sort of a big chunk of, it shapes the rest of the series. And it's of course drawn on the Greek myth of Orpheus and his wife, who he actually goes to rescue her from the underworld, but he's told not to look at her when he leaves, but he does, and so she disappears. But in this version, Orpheus is Morpheus's son. The whole pivotal part of this series is because Morpheus basically denies Orpheus when he comes to him for help. And that really shapes and sort of burdens Dream's character for most of the book that we've seen. A lot of that sort of disconnectedness from that we sense in him, we realize now that this was sort of a very pivotal part of that. I love how that myth, it then incorporates, as you said, Lynn, all of these other characters. It incorporates death, it incorporates destruction, and we start seeing them as a proper family rather than just these beings that we've been seeing them before.
as a proper family with all the various dramas, entanglements, yes. and resentments yes. that a family has. I think it's important to say that.
Yeah. This is also, I think, the part where we get to see Morpheus at his worst. I struggle to relate to him so much when it comes to his relationship with Orpheus. I'm siding with Orpheus, I'm sympathizing with Orpheus, but I feel like he is being very, very difficult with Orpheus. I'm like, oh my God, Morpheus. I mean, I like him as a character, but I think this is peak, the annoying, the, you know, a bit of a jerk Morpheus. Mm. Yeah, being so rigid in his stance and whatnot, right?
And yet you also see that everybody says over and over again, you are like your father. Has anybody ever told you that? You are like your father. And I think in Orpheus's struggle and in the mistakes that he makes as well, you do see a lot of his dad. So that, again, going back to this idea of family, makes it feel, despite the fact that it is set in ancient Greece, rooted in mythology and all the rest of it, makes it feel relatable. It makes it feel like, yeah, you know what? I think we've all kind of been there, even without the poisonous snake.
I agree with Hanif that this is peak Morpheus. I love that. And I think that there are two distinct parts in this whole series where I really felt like I disliked him. One was this, and the other was what he did with Nada, which we discussed in our earlier show. But I also think that it's important to have peak Morpheus because he's never been portrayed as a nice person. And I think it's important for the story to kind of go to those places for you to understand why what comes later is important.
Peak Morpheus literally shapes the peaks of the stories. It's the moment where things break and then they have to reform around it. And it is, you know, this sort of behavior, whether we like it or not, that brings us there. So we're talking today about Neil Gaiman's Sandman, specifically volumes 6 and 7, volume 6 being Fables and Reflections, which is a collection of shorter stories with a chunk of it being dedicated to his son Orpheus and that family story. And after this, we're going to be talking about the continuation of this idea of family and what it means in terms of the endless in volume 7, which is Brief Lives. If you are reading Sandman, if you have read Sandman, let us know what you think. You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 and tweet us at BFM Radio.
Brainy, fancy material. BFM 89.9.
Dream when I want you, in my arms when I want you, and all your charms whenever I want you. All I have to do is dream.
Hello everyone, you are listening to Buy the Book with Lynn and Sharmila, and today of course our special guest Hanif, back for his quarterly book club in which we are slowly but surely making our way through Neil Gaiman's, some might say, magnum opus, Sandman. And we spoke earlier about Fables and Reflections. Now it's time for Brief Lives.
So I will upfront say Brief Lives is one of my hands-down favorite volumes in the whole series. It's not always the easiest to read, but because I love the Endless, who are his siblings, and I love how much this book focuses on them, not each of them necessarily, but in particular, it focuses on two of my favorite characters, who are Delirium and Destruction. And it's just such a... It's a book that really develops that idea of them both as concepts, which the series has highlighted many times, because they are not just representations of dream or destruction or death. They are actually also dream, destruction, death. But this book almost problematizes that a little bit, because there's also this idea of, well, what if you don't want to be that anymore?
Firstly, thank you for pointing out how difficult this book can be, because I initially struggled to go through the first few chapters of the book, only because while I like Delirium as a character, I think the fact that the way she's written and the way even her thought bubbles or her speech bubbles are written makes it slightly difficult to to digest. And
like
also,
you feel the annoyance people feel around her.
Exactly, yeah. And I think maybe it's done intentionally, right? I think that's the beauty. But it's also a bit of a slow burner in that sense, because I think based on the summary of the book at the back, you kind of know that they're going to embark on a journey to find destruction. But the first few chapters was, for me, were a bit slow in that sense. I was struggling a bit to get through the whole thing. But I think when they arrive and they met destruction, I think the story sort of like pick up. And I think the dynamics between the siblings. I think because this was our first time meeting destruction, and destruction has always been told as this one brother who's there, and he decided to leave the family. And you always, at least personally for me, I was always curious to know more about destruction. So it was a rewarding book in that sense, that I was finally able to meet destruction and perhaps understand his motive and reasoning behind leaving the family.
So again, this is a book that kind of sets the stage for a lot of things that A, Gaiman tends to do, and B, he is going to do, because this is American Gods in many ways. It is American Gods. You know, it's a road trip story. It is a road trip story with an unlikely member of your family. You know, that there's a lot going on there. But the other thing it does is it also plays with, like you said, Shamila, this idea of what does it mean to seek your brother? What does it mean when your brother is destruction? Because, of course, if you say the sentence, yes, my younger sister and I are going to seek destruction, that means something quite different to my younger sister and I are going to look for our brother who kind of stopped talking to everybody a little while ago. And yet this book does both those things, right? Mm-hmm. Like as they set out on their path to look for their brother, destruction ends up finding them and ends up finding, because they meet his old friends, right? And they end up meeting the friends that destruction has touched as well. So it's a really fascinating way of looking at it, I think, but also it's just a good story. It's really nicely told.
They actually do that on so many levels. I mean, Delirium actually goes to ask her other siblings on this quest as well. And just like what you said, you know, in the presence of their sibling Desire says, well, no, I don't want to do that with you. And the irony, which Delirium points out, is, well, but that's what I want. You are Desire. So the irony of you not wanting me to go after my Desire. But when she leaves, that kind of leaves you thinking, well, did Desire plant that idea in her head in the first place? Was that something that Desire wanted to happen? And similarly, she goes to their sister Despair, and Despair doesn't want to be a part of this, but the net result of that is actually despair for herself, because she actually really loves destruction. You get a real sense of even characters like Despair, who are on the surface very unlikable. This book does a lot to help you see how they're both trapped by their roles, but also kind of defined by them. And I think there's something very profound about that idea.
Yeah, and we also get that resolution about Orpheus finally in this book, and I find that quite interesting in how they use destruction to somehow get Dream to resolve that conflict, right, with his son. Of course, if you read it back to back, you'll be able to also get the resolution from the Orpheus story that you read in the previous book, right? Overall, I guess, yeah, it is despite slightly being a difficult read initially, I was like genuinely happy with how it turned out to be, reading the seventh book, I guess.
Oh, I mean, happy is such a difficult word to use.
Oh, yeah, I know.
With this volume, look, I love Destruction. I think that he's actually my favorite sibling, because he combines the, in some ways, the depth and thoughtfulness of Dream with the spunkiness of Death, and a remove and a sense of humor and an empathy that the rest of them simply lack, outside of Despair. And who wants to spend that much time with Despair and her pet rats? Mm.
He's the most human of all of them.
Yes, and maybe it's quite telling of our tiny little minds that we would think we like the one who's most like us. But I really like him. You also meet his dog, Barnabas. And in this story that is quite heavy, that features a lot of death, you know, there's a lot of death and destruction, really. In the midst of all that, to have these comic interludes with the man himself, whom they're looking for, who's kind of like, they're coming, whatever, is quite lovely.
Yes, and even just the way he's drawn throughout the book, and that's one thing that many of these volumes do, because there's so many artists working on different stories within the volume, you get such a huge variety of art. I love the so-called visual evolution of Destruction, because you see him in several different forms, and his sort of final, he's gotten rid of his beard. Oh, I like his beard. That kind of, he's just now a hippie who walks barefoot in an island somewhere. I really love that because it feels so relatable.
Being bad at everything because he destroys everything he touches.
But making art all the same. Like, there's something so sweet and funny and absurd about that whole thing.
Coming back to, I guess, Hanif's chosen adjective to describe the book, which is
Pink
happy.
Morphine? Oh, sorry.
I wanted to say that I found this book difficult partly because of how it sets up the rest of the story. And that happens because there is a big resolution that happens in this book of a story that has really haunted Morpheus and therefore haunted us as readers for over the course of this entire thing. And it's heartbreaking. And it's not heartbreaking in a peak Morpheus way. I mean, we meet him at the start dealing with a breakup and I'm like, dear God. Dear
There's rain
God.
Everywhere.
He's
no
like
one
that
should
friend.
Talk to him.
Yeah. That friend you avoid.
even his dream minions think that. They're just like, okay, another one of these.
Correct. It's like, I've taken the phone call too many times. Sorry, I want to be a good friend, but you know. And so he's that guy. But the sadness that he's experiencing at the end, that's a very different thing. And that hit me really hard. There is one panel in particular after he does something that he very badly does not want to do that still breaks my heart when I think about it.
Mm. No, I just, I cried. I always cry every time I get to that part of the book.
Yeah. Can I just defend myself a bit? I would like to say that I guess I'm happy with the resolution, with how the book ties some loose ends. I'm happy that the conflict between Morpheus and Orpheus has been resolved, quote unquote. But generally, the book is not necessarily a happy book. Yeah, that one I have to somehow agree, I guess. To certain, yeah.
So I think it's no coincidence that, as you pointed out, Lynn, the book starts off with a grand melancholic fit, basically. But as the book goes along, and when it comes to the end and the heartbreak and the true emotion that he's left with at the end, we realize that the journey of that book has been one of transformation, that he's finally realized, and Destruction says this many times, he says destruction is change. You need destruction for there to be change. And in many ways, this book is the destruction of Morpheus as he's known himself to be. And there's something very sad about it, but also something that tells you, well, but maybe that change is good for him.
I think it's satisfying from a storytelling point of view. And that's what that gives you, you know? So despite the fact that it's tough, it is a difficult thing to happen, the way the story is told is so satisfying. It makes sense. There is a sense of inevitability as well, because after all, we think, reading a tragedy, which would mean that somebody is kind of inexorably being drawn along this path. And you get that sense in this book. I also wanted to say that while we touched on this a little bit earlier, but the interactions between Dream and Delirium are simply the best.
They are so good. They're so funny, but also weirdly profound sometimes. And Hanif, you talked about her thought bubbles. I mean, we've mentioned this before, how each of the Endless get their own distinct lettering and thought bubbles. But Delirium's and the things that she just, random stuff like, you know, what is the word for when someone does this, that this happens, and then Endless, like, there's no word for that.
On the inside of an eyeball.
Yes. But I was going to ask, I know, Lynn, you said Destruction was your favorite, but Hanif, do you have a favorite of the Endless?
As much as it's cliche, I like Morpheus, as much as I'm quite annoyed with him all the time, and also like Death. So I guess my preferences are a bit more cliche in that sense. Yeah, Death for simply being
Death.
Cool.
I love every time she shows up, and I think he very cleverly uses her sparingly.
Yeah, and Destiny's okay as well, but my favorite characters are still, I guess, Dream and Death.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing not to like.
Yeah, I know. Mine is Delirium for a weird reason, although I love Destruction. But maybe we don't see as much of him as well.
So this, I think, sets us up pretty neatly for the last time, brothers and sisters, that I will stand in my gallery and hold your sigil and call your name.
God, that went deep.
For a gathering in which we're going to go through volumes 8, 9 and 10, which really deal, I think, with the fallout of the action that we see Morpheus take in book 7. So do join us for that. It will be in 2021 when hopefully the world is better. The world is a better place and we can all be in the same room, but who knows? Okay, so if you are reading Sandman, let us know what you think. If you're interested in it, also, we would love to hear from you. You can, of course, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio, and write to us at buythebook@bfm.my. Brings us to footnotes, and as is customary in this particular version of our book club, what we like to do is take a moment to recommend graphic novels because we don't get to talk about it much in the rest of our show. Sharmila, you want to go first?
Yes, I recently got to read a graphic novel that I've been sort of keeping in the back burner for a while, and I'm so glad I did. It's called Nimona, and it's by Noel Stevenson, and it won the Eisner in 2015. And it's actually a young adult series of web comics that Noel Stevenson first premiered online, but then eventually got published as a full volume. And, you know, I heard so much about it, and it's so delightful. It's set in this, it's set in sort of a world where, how do I put it? So it's both magic and sort of steampunk mad science-y, where there are these knights and villains, and the two main characters are a former knight called Ballister Blackheart, and the knight whose job it is to defeat him, Ambrosius Goldenloin. Yes, I know. So this is the world it lives in. So Ballister basically invents these mad scientific creations to conquer the world or whatever. And one day this little girl named Nimona shows up in his lab and declares herself his assistant. And he's like, wait, what? Who are you? And she's like, why would I want you to help me? And then she reveals that she's a shapeshifter. So she can shift into different animals, into different creatures. And the rest of the story is both self-contained in the sense that they're little bits of adventures they go on, but there's also this really wonderful overall arc. And there's this whole idea of, you know, Ballister is not necessarily the bad guy, Ambrosius is not necessarily the good guy. Just such a delightful read. And the art is lovely. It's because it's YA, it's not very complex, but it also really suits the genre. And just a great, great example of female characters, but also very complex male characters.
And again, it's called?
Nimona by Noel Stevenson.
Hanif?
Okay, I'm going to recommend a superhero comic, but something that I find quite interesting, despite being a superhero comic, by Marvel. So this is Spider-Man Life Story, written by Chip Darsky, and it's drawn by Mark Bagley. Mark Bagley is, of course, the artist more well-known for drawing Ultimate Spider-Man. So the story is about Spider-Man, but told from the perspective of Spider-Man throughout the years. So it started out in the year 1960s, and it goes through all the way till the late 2000s. But essentially, it's a retelling of the origin of Spider-Man, Peter Parker, through that perspective. So the thing about reading superhero comics is that sometimes time can be quite relative, right? So sometimes Peter Parker is stuck in his 20s for 10 years in comic book run in real life, right? So for this story, what the author is trying to do is that he's trying to tell this story of what if Peter Parker lives through his life from 1960s through all the way to 2000. Till he's old, right? So from that perspective, you can see, I guess, Peter Parker and Spider-Man going through the war, the Vietnam War, and how he influenced that. And it was also told to include all the Spider-Man lore. You know, if you're familiar with Spider-Man, you would probably be familiar with some major moments in the story of the character, right? So, for example, during the clone, there's this phase where Spider-Man had to face off with his clones, and then there's also the time when Aunt May passed away and things like that. So it's an interesting perspective to look at how the origin of Spider-Man, the story of Spider-Man, can be told from those eras. It has 6 volumes, so we can go through 1960s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. So by the time we reach 2000, Peter Parker is an old man. Imagine going through a a more canonical, more grounded, rooted chronology of Peter Parker and Spider-Man as the character. For me, it's a very interesting take to the character. In case if you are not, I guess, tired of superhero movies or superhero books, yeah, I think this is something worth looking at.
And sort of self-contained, right?
Yes, because, it's a self-contained graphic novel, volume 1 to volume 6. Yeah, you can just get the trade paperback and just read it in one go.
Nice. And again, that's called?
Spider-Man Life Story.
Nice. I'm going to cheat slightly and review recommendations that you both made earlier, because they've actually been informing the graphic novels that I've been reading this year. So in case anybody needed a sort of second opinion, here I am. And it's on two things that we brought up, I don't know now, in I think our first episode of doing this.
So 20 one, years ago.
Yes, 50 sometimes. One is Sculptor by Scott McCloud, which I think, Hanif, you recommended and also you loaned to me. And I actually thought that it was a really lovely read. It is... it's kind of deceptively thick. When you first look at it, it looks like a tome of a book. And then when you go through it, it's actually kind of... it's a quick little love story. And I think if you like peak Morpheus, then you will like the characters, because it's it tells the story of young love, right? But it's also infused with what happens when you include... you know, when you give somebody powers, and but you don't give them the powers to solve the things that actually need solving, things like mental illness, things like death and time and all that. And so it doesn't go as much into it as, say, Neil Gaiman would, but it's more grounded. It's more like, look, this is how I would truly react if I were in my 20s and something like this happened to me. And I loved it for that read, especially because it's, and he says this at the end, he's a middle-aged author now, and this was a love story for him and his wife, whom he met when he was much younger, which was really sweet. On the complete opposite end of that is Sharmila's recommendation, which is Monstrous.
Oh.
And I've been racing my way through that. I'm all the way up to volume 4 now. It's still ongoing. Volume 5 is lost somewhere in the depths of a book fulfillment center. I don't know when I'll see it, but it's just the best thing. I love it so much. Every time I get a volume, I sit down and finish it in half an hour, because I just love the world. It's so rich and textured. It's building its own canon and mythology. If you are a nerd, you know, you will love it. If you love action movies, you will love it. If you love female characters, there's just a lot going on in it. And I really, really am in love with Monstrous. I cannot wait to see it never get adapted.
I love that you've actually surpassed me, because I had to take a pause, because when I finished reading volume 2 or 3, I believe, the next hadn't come out yet.
Fulfillment centers, man. I don't know where they are. So yeah, that's my recommendation. It's just a resounding second. So in our next episode, you can expect me to talk about both your books again.
Which will loan you and just make this whole process easier.
Thank you. All right, so that is it. We're always on the lookout for good graphic novel recommendations. So if you've read anything that you'd like to share with us, you can WhatsApp 018-789-8899. You can also tweet us at BFM Radio and write to us at buythebook@bfm.my. Hanif, thank you so much for joining us on this journey.
Thank you for having me.
You are listening to Buy the Book, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.